You're listening to episode 4 of the Book Thingo podcast, featuring lively discussions about romance books, culture, and happy endings. Ainsley Payton and Jodie McAllister join us for this episode, which was recorded on August 17, 2013, at the Romance Writers of Australia conference in Fremantle. Book Thingo would like to acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which this episode was recorded, the Whadjuk people. We also acknowledge the contributions of Aboriginal Australians to our shared literary heritage.
Welcome to the Book Thingo podcast, talking about books we love, especially romance. Kill a fairy fast on the Book Thingo podcast.
Welcome back to the Book Thingo podcast. I'm Kat Mayo from bookthingo.com.au, an Aussie blog for romance readers. In this episode, I chat with Ainsley Payton and Jodie McAllister about compulsory demisexuality, which is a fancy academic term that describes the link between sex and love in romance books. We also have an email address for the podcast, so if you'd like to send me your comments or feedback, or if you'd like to suggest a topic or a guest, please send an email to podcast@bookthingo.com.au. And now that's out of the way, in this episode, I sat down with author Ainsley Payton and academic Jodie McAllister for a very, very long chat about so many things. Ainsley Payton writes contemporary romances featuring non-traditional characters in complicated situations. She has written, among other things, a surfer hero who takes up competitive ballroom dancing, a chauffeur heroine, and a hero who works as a nanny and dreams of opening his own childcare centre. You can find her work at Ainsley Payton, that's AINSLIEPATON.com.au. Jodie McAllister is a literary historian who recently submitted her doctoral thesis on virginity loss narratives in Western literature. At the time of this recording, she was still partway through her PhD, and she had just presented a paper at the academic symposium preceding the RWA conference. Jodie is Book Thingo's Virgin Horny Pants Specialist, and that is an official title. She can also be found at the Momentum Moonlight blog, where she is renowned for her recaps of The Bold and the Beautiful, as well as her theatre review blog, Theatre from the Backseat. When we recorded this podcast, we had no set questions to lead us, so the conversation meanders quite a bit. Ainsley was also suffering from a terrible cold, and the only reason she doesn't sound like she's about to collapse is due to our fantastic audio producer, Rudy Bremer, whose technical magic needs no cuff button. You can find information on all the books we talk about in this episode by going to bookthingo.com.au/podcast and clicking on episode number 4. Jodie presented a paper at yesterday's academic panel. I wonder if you can just sort of talk us through what you presented.
My doctoral thesis, which I am hopefully two-thirds-ish of the way through, is about virginity loss narratives in Western literature. And so I look a lot at romance fiction, and I look at autobiographical stories, and I read them against each other, and I'm looking for how they relate to history and those kind of historical trends. I'm technically in the history faculty, not the English faculty, so this historical aspect is really, really important to me. Anyway, the paper I was giving yesterday was largely about what I think is kind of the governing paradigm of the romance, which is something I like to call compulsory demisexuality. What that means is that you can't experience sexual attraction unless you have an emotional romantic attachment to your partner. And if you're demisexual in real life, then you can experience pleasure with a number of people, provided you have an emotional or romantic attachment to them. But in the romance, I argue that this kind of intersects with an idea of one true love. And so once the hero and heroine meet, it becomes impossible for them to experience sexual pleasure or desire for anyone else. And I was talking about this specifically in relation to Mills and Boone, because I think it is a big, big critical mistake to talk about romance as a monolithic genre, because there are so many different subgenres and things are articulated so differently. So I was looking at sort of the history of the sex scene in Mills and Boone and the way this has changed over time, and the way the relationship between love has changed. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that in the modern Mills and Boone, probably since about the 70s, and it's kind of going more and more and more in this direction, this idea of compulsory demisexuality is gendered. So the heroine usually, not always, but usually is demisexual. So she explicitly or implicitly links love and sex. And with virgin heroines, you see this a lot because they're like, no, I have maintained my virginity because I don't want to sleep with someone if I'm not in love. And then the hero, on the other hand, is usually, you know, has had many, many sexual partners and presumably has had a good sex life up until the point he meets the heroine. And I think, importantly, the point that he sleeps with her. Because if she is demisexual, he becomes demisexual, and she kind of gives it to him as a sexually transmitted disease.
Which I love.
They have sex and he catches feelings. But I was just talking about it in relation to sort of two key texts yesterday, one from the 1930s, which is so, so interesting, the way portrayals of sex and love have changed from the 30s. So it was Shatter the Sky by Denise Robbins. And then I talked about a Lynn Graham from 2009 called Desert Prince, Bride of Innocence.
So can you take us through the history of Mills and Boone? You mentioned it yesterday, and yeah. It's really fascinating because it kind of debunks some myths that we've kind of just taken for granted and assumed that they were correct.
Yeah, well, there's a scholar called Jay Dixon who wrote this really awesome book about Mills and Boone. It's called The Romance Fiction of Mills and Boone, 1909 to the 1990s.
Is Jay Gould?
Yes. It's Jay with a small J, like J-A-Y, and then Dixon with a big D. Really, really interesting book if you can read it. So, so, so fascinating. And she argues that most criticism of Mills and Boone has been completely ahistorical. And if you look at a lot of criticism, she's completely right. If you look at sort of texts, I mean, even now I have to generalise because it's such a huge, huge genre, but you look at texts from kind of the early period of Mills and Boone, so they start in 1909, and I'm talking to sort of just up to about the Second World War here, kind of end of the 30s. Really, really interesting and radical things are going on in these texts. You see a lot of divorce, you see a lot of adultery, and a lot of infidelity. Like the book I was talking about yesterday, by Denise Robbins, the heroine, Carrie, her fiancé dies a few days before they're supposed to get married, and she's just heartbroken. And she ends up marrying this other guy called Ralph, just out of convenience. And she doesn't love him. And there are no explicit sex scenes in this book, but their sex life kind of is represented, and there's this scene on their wedding night where she's like, oh, she gave herself generously to him, but she experienced no pleasure.
Right.
And she goes on, explicitly to think about their sex life several times during the book, and she's like, the reason that she can't experience pleasure is that she doesn't love him.
Mm.
And there's this idea that there's this wonderful quotation, I wish I could remember it off the top of my head, I gave it yesterday, where she's like, a man can do without this kind of emotional connection, but a woman can't. And she ends up, they go on their honeymoon to Malaga, and she meets this other guy, Dickon, who's the cousin of her fiancé that's died, and he's pretty much identical. And she falls headlong in love with him. And so the transgression here comes from the fact that she's married to someone else. And if you tried to pull that in a modern Mills and Boone, that just would not fly. Would not fly at all. And this is not a particularly unusual text for this period.
Yeah.
And Denise Robbins is probably the biggest, most popular writer in this time. She, a few years after this book is published, she gets poached by another firm called Nicholson and Watson. So her Mills and Boone career ends in about 35, 36, even though she goes on to write many, many more romance novels.
That's
after this.
That's interesting, because now the first person that the heroine has sex with, that's how you know who she's going to end up with,
Whereas there's much more emphasis on not on erotic love in these earlier ones. There's the love between the heroine and the hero is kind of this metaphysical, transcendent thing. And if there's sex represented, it's usually not between the heroine and hero. And there are exceptions. Like there's a book from 1915 by Louise Girard called The Virgin's Treasure, where there's no explicit sex, but it's kind of still on the page a little bit, and it's talked about fairly euphemistically. And so they sleep together, but it's very much the exception, not the rule.
Right.
Like, there's another one from 1928, also by Denise Robbins, called Desire is Blind, which opens with her being seduced by this... The heroine's called Thea, and she gets seduced by this evil lawyer called Bevel, and she goes off in search of him, ends up in a marriage of convenience to this other guy who's about twice her age. He's actually a virgin, even though he's, like, 40, and he hates the lawyer and is, like, trying to get revenge on him, and... The gender politics are so, so different. I mean, there's kind of, in the modern romance, kind of he that getteth the virginity getteth the girl.
Yeah, he's going to be the redeemed bad boy.
Yeah, and that absolutely doesn't happen. Like, in this one, like, Thea is kind of conned into having sex, but there's still this kind of sense that, you know, you really need to interrogate your feelings before you make any decisions.
Kind of like a learning experience as opposed to the one true.
Yeah, and there's no judgment placed on the fact that she's been seduced, and she tries to hide this from lots of people, and her husband's like, I don't even care. Like, it really doesn't bother me at all.
So I was so surprised to hear this, because I had only really thought of them in that conservative framework.
Yeah.
And so this was a whole different take on the morality presented in the books.
Yeah.
That kind of blew my mind. It was great.
Well, it's really interesting if you look at what's happening historically. And if you were a woman in Britain up to 1937, if you wanted to get a divorce, you had to not only prove that your husband was cheating on you, but that he was also, like, abusing you. There was at least, you had to have adultery plus another reason.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of, considering how much emphasis there is on women in bad marriages who then escape these marriages, it's a really interesting mirror. And, like, I do a lot of work on Denise Robinson's books, and sometimes the husband is killed. Sometimes, like, in Shatter the Sky, he falls in love with someone else and he will divorce the heroine.
Yeah.
She can, like, the heroine can never initiate the divorce because she doesn't have that power, really. But, she kind of gets out of it and gets to live happily
ever
after.
So were the books presenting women a kind of choice in a historical context that they didn't have?
Yeah, or a space that they often weren't allowed to access,
yeah.
I think, which is, it's so, so interesting. And I haven't even begun to come to terms with half of this, really. And there's not very much scholarly work on these early Mills and Boone at all. I mean,
yeah.
So then when does Mills and Boone move from that kind of framework to the more conservative framework?
Well, it happens a little bit after the war. So sort of war books during Mills and Boone are really interesting because they hardly ever mention the war. Oh, after the war, they'll start mentioning the war. But during the war, Mills and Boone managed to get their paper ration on the grounds that they kept up morale for women.
Far out.
Yeah. I mean, it was a reduced paper ration, but they still managed to get them.
An essential service.
Yeah, which is awesome. And, like, the fact that publishers managed to successfully argue this year after year, because they had to keep justifying why they would get their paper ration. And so but then in the 50s, this conservatism really comes in because you have the influence of the Irish market is big. Like, there's a book that, I can't remember if it's in the late 30s or the 40s, a book gets published that has abortion in it, and the Irish market goes batshit. And
as they would, I know, you blame the Irish Catholics.
For all these, like, taboos and religion.
Yeah. Yeah. That went for how many years was this conservative period?
Oh, it was kind of the same as the long 1950s, you know? So, you know how the 50s is kind of more than a decade? But also, so you've got the Irish market, you've got the serialisation deals they had with women's magazines, and the biggest one of those was with Women's Weekly, and the editor was Biddy Johnson, and she had these really...
What a name. What a name.
Biddy, Winifred.
But and they partnered with Women's Weekly for ages.
Yeah, many, many years.
I remember reading serialised Mills and Boone in Women's Weekly.
Do you?
Yeah.
And
you're older than you look. Yeah.
Thanks.
I shouldn't
have admitted that.
She's big on sexual tension, but there could never be any hint of sex. Mm. So there'd be books where she'd be like, okay, it is not clear that the heroine did not spend the night at the hero's place. This must be changed. But the other interesting thing about her is that she kind of really pushed this idea of the alpha hero. Oh, she pushed this idea of what she used to call for the hero glamorous unapproachability. And I think, like, we really have a lot to thank Biddy Johnson for.
That's all of Harlequin present.
Yeah, pretty much. And then the other reason for conservatism is in 1957, Mills and Boone start their partnership with Harlequin, which was at this point a reprinting partnership. And the Bonnycastle family, particularly Mary Bonnycastle, who owned Harlequin and controlled it at this time, were very, very conservative. And so you had this strange situation where Harlequin were reprinting these books for the North American market that weren't the ones that were selling the best in Britain. You had people like Lillian Warren, who wrote under, she had a few pen names, Celine Conway, Catherine Blair, Rosalind Brett, who were huge in the UK. And Alan Boone of Mills and Boone was trying to push them, so he claims, in a more racy direction, though, you know, if that's true or not. But then the Bonnycastles would only really, like, they loved the medicals, because they were all about these very sort of starched nurses having these terribly sensible affairs with sensible doctors.
Are they any different now?
Well, apparently medicals are the most popular line in Australia. That came out in the Art Panel, category panel, had Mills and Boone folks in there, and they said medical is very popular in Australia and France.
But who knows?
Doctors and nurses.
And, I mean, out of there, in the 60s, you get people like Betty Neals beginning to emerge. She was really interesting case.
They're reprinting her stuff now.
Yeah.
I think Harlequin has a massive backlist.
She wrote bazillions. But, I mean, she is really interesting because she never, ever changes her style. Okay. As the books get sexier and sexier and sexier, and Betty Neal's never changes. She just stays there. And she keeps selling. Like, she was some of the first romance I ever read. She was my grandma's favourite. And I used to pinch them off her shelves.
Are those the Mills and Boons that ended with a kiss? Or are they slightly racier? Or?
Oh, I mean, I haven't read that many Betty Neals. I probably read, like, I don't know, four. And she wrote, like, a million. But they're really, really tame, the Dutch doctor books.
Okay.
Like, they're just very sensible.
Because the first Mills and Boon I ever read, my grandmother's garage, it ended with a kiss. That was the most that they ever did. The second that I read... was a Charlotte Lamb. It did not just end with a kiss. It had oral sex in the car.
And you thought differently about cousins. Your grandmother.
No, that was my mother's. All
right. Well, Betty Neal's quite famously called the sexier Mills and Boons gynecological training manuals. Oh. So, and apparently she was inspired to write them when her daughter was looking through Mills and Boon in, I don't know, a library or a shop or something in the 60s and was like, oh, I'm sick of all this pornography.
Oh,
and it's like, well, I don't know exactly which one she was reading because they were so, so tame.
Right.
I mean, probably Lillian Warren was pushing them in a slightly racy direction and then she dies in 1961 in a car crash. So who knows what would have happened if she had lived longer. But then you have authors like Violet Winspear starts to come through. Her first book is 1961. And Anne Mather and Anne Hampson. And they're the core that form presents in 1973. And Mills and Boon is kind of forced to become sexier. Not just because of the erotic historical, The Flame and the Fowl is published in 1972, but you've also got soap operas coming up in this time period. In 1956, Peyton Place by Grace Metalius is published, and there's this kind of erotic novels. And you've also got the pulp gothics in the 60s, people like Victoria Holt, who are writing very dark, sort of sexually intense heroes. And so, allegedly... According to historian Paul Gresko, I don't know how I can possibly check this claim, but the first sex scene in Mills and Boon is in 1967. The first on-the-page sex scene in The Garden of Persephone by Nan Asquith. I've actually read this book, and it's very, very tame, and I don't think it's actually that explicit, and I really don't know what metric he's using to determine what constitutes a sex scene.
How do you measure what constitutes a sex scene?
It's really...
When is a sex scene a sex scene?
Yeah, like, I mean, this is a question that I'm going to have to think about a lot
more.
Well,
you know...
So if you go back to when the partnership was with Women's Weekly, a sex scene was... almost any suggestion of a sex scene.
Yeah.
Because the positioning inside a family magazine, I guess.
Yeah.
A homemaker magazine.
There could never be any suggestion that they'd had sex. It had to be really, really clear that their interactions were only the ones you saw on the page and there was no funny business going on behind the scenes.
So how did those books... What was the conclusion of those books? What was the happy ending of those books?
Well, they got together. They established their long-term monogamous partnership, you know.
So they held hands.
Kissing.
They could kiss. All right.
They
couldn't take their clothes.
I was thinking it's very limited here. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess they could make out a little bit, maybe, but going beyond kissing was kind of a big no-no.
Right.
And so in this period, sex kind of exists, this period beyond the happily ever after. So sex and love almost become the same thing.
So in actual fact, they were only really happy for nows.
Because
you didn't get the ever after bit, because we didn't go that distance with them.
Well, we know they got married.
We know. Do we?
Yeah.
We know.
Yeah.
Okay. They were secure. Okay.
Yeah. Otherwise, you know, the heroine's virtue.
Okay. There's some morality about the kiss.
And Mary Bonnycastle and Biddy Johnson would not be having with that. No.
Just picturing these ladies in twin sets and pearl necklaces. Mm. Actually,
they'd be so ruthless.
I'm pretty sure it's a Mills and Boon. It was definitely category sometime in the 90s. And I don't know whether it was a new release when I read it or whether I bought it secondhand somewhere. Where they obliquely refer to anal sex. And whenever people talk about we never have these taboo subjects in Mills and Boon, I always think, but I'm pretty sure I've read them.
Yeah.
They don't say it, but they'll have hints where you
I've
know,
read
she's
one with anal sex for
she's,
sure.
you know, lying on her stomach and something interesting's happening or his hands wandering in sort of, and she's like, ooh, what are you doing?
I'm trying to remember the one I've read with anal sex.
Wish.
It's from the 90s and there's a piano somehow involved.
I wish I kept them.
Of course.
Yeah. And I feel like the heroine is maybe an opera singer. But,
those opera singers, they're a bit loosey.
I've read so many Mills and Boons now that remembering the titles is...
What made you interested in concentrating on Mills and Boon?
Okay, there are a lot of reasons, really. When I first had the notion, it was shameful to say because I thought they were kind of funny. Like, and I still think this about Harlequin Presents. They're so crazy sometimes. And I think that's some of the pleasure of it, you know, that you're like, no, this is insane and it's just rolling with it. It owns how crazy it is.
But actually, I think that allows you to accept ridiculous plots. Yeah. And sort of the ultra alpha behaviour that you normally wouldn't
expect. There's a big suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
Because you already know it's kind of fantastical.
Yeah. And then, but I think it really...
That's the entertainment value of it. That's where you... As a writer, you are actually an entertainer.
Yeah. When I really decided to study romance, though, and I mean, I was tossing this up for a while, but it was when I worked out just how dominating romance was in the publishing market, because it's so, so huge. Mm. I mean, basically supported the book industry during the recession. And I was like, oh, hang on, there's not very much scholarship about these books that people are actually reading. Isn't this important?
Yeah.
And I mean, I get all the, like, I know romance readers get this all the time, like, oh, why do you read these books? Why do you read these books? And I get, oh, you're so smart, Jodie. Why are you studying these stupid books instead of, you know, something erudite? And it's like, well, this is what people are reading.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It is, of course, it is important to study what people are reading. Don't you think it's important to study that? And there's no comeback to that.
They're
you know?
Cultural artifacts.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And, like, as a historian, the way they interact with history and the way they develop is so interesting, which is... It's fascinating that people, like, critics have flattened them for so long. And I think romance scholarship is getting really, like, awesome and trendy now because we're beginning to engage more with individual texts rather than just talking about the genre.
Oh, so that's what you mean by flattened them. They've treated them all as though they're the same homogenous whole.
Yeah, well, if you look at some of the early criticism of romance, so I'm thinking about articles like in 1979, Anne Barr-Snitow writes this article called Mass Market Romance Pornography for Women is Different. And it's based off, I think, she makes sweeping conclusions about the genre based off, I think, 5 Mills and Boons. Yeah. And in 1982, Tanya Mildleski writes Loving with a Vengeance, and she cites, I think, 7? Maybe it's the other way around. So maybe Snitow does 7 and Mildleski does 5. 7 and 5.
Yes, yeah, so very somewhere. Small sample sizes.
Yeah. And I think that is just a massive scholarly oversight.
I think in any other discipline would you get away with such a small sample size?
Ooh. Right. Well, I mean, I was not a scholar in the 80s.
No.
I was not born when these books were written. So
some of them I wasn't born for either, so it's okay.
Yeah, I think it's because people haven't known how to read them for some time. And then there's been all this anxiety about the reader, and yet I don't think people have really thought about what readers are getting out of the text and the process of reading in a very meaningful way, which is why romance scholarship at the moment is so exciting, because these are the kind of questions that we're looking at.
Is it because people thought, because they were trash, that what women were getting out of them was bad stuff?
Pretty much.
So therefore it's not worthy of any discussion.
And there's this implicit assumption that people read them and mimic them, like they kind of blindly imbibe them, and it's like, well, no.
Yeah.
This is really demonstrably not the case.
Yeah.
Which is one of the good things that I have a lot of problems with this ethnographical study that Janice Radway did in 1984 called Reading the Romance, which is very big in scholarship and is now kind of frowned upon for many reasons. But she really does think about how readers use texts. And I think some of her conclusions are flawed, but she raises some important questions thinking about the process of reading. And
but concluding something along the lines of, if you read lots of romance about alpha heroes, in your real life, you'll be looking for an alpha hero.
Well, the last sentence in the book, this is paraphrasing, so I can't remember it exactly, but she concludes that romances do not give the reader a comprehensive program by which their life can be organised. And it's like...
Fancy that.
I mean, considering how little scholarship there was in the field at the moment, in a way you kind of can't blame her, but then you look at it now and you're like, oh, what were you thinking? And she rewrites the foreword to it in, I think it's 1991, and even in that forward, you can see a little bit of, oh, what was I thinking?
But romance also has its, especially category, has its own form.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to explain to people who don't read category romance what you mean by that. And they're like, it's just a book. You read it like any other book. And you try to explain that it is a book, but there's a way to read it. And because you read it that way, writers write it that way. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's kind of a...
Is it a chicken and egg thing, though? Do writers write it that way or readers read it that way?
I think it's partly the word count. There are certain things that are forced on the writer because they only have so many pages to fill.
That's true.
Nora Roberts famously calls the category Swan Lake in a Phone Booth.
I love it.
Wow, that's great. Are two
involved?
Toshus, that's great. So that, I guess that's where the sense of the slight ridiculous comes from. Because it is slightly ridiculous to have such a grand scale in such a tiny...
I mean, I don't think it's a problem that they're so spectacular. This kind of metric of realism we have for analysing text is very coded masculine. It's like if you think about the way masculinity and femininity are constructed, you know, masculinity is, you know, rational and femininity is emotional. And so the realist is valued as this metric for analysing texts. And people go, oh, that's not realistic, that's not realistic, that's not realistic. And you go, well, is it supposed to be? Why do we value realism over spectacular?
Yeah, so the other framework could be, is it entertaining? Is it a rollicking good read? Yeah.
Well, this is something I work on with Athena Bellis at the University of Melbourne. She has a website. Her PhD, which she's running at the moment, is on teen girl film and TV. She has a website called sparkleScene.com where I do podcasts with her sometimes, and we talk about the teen girl viewer and the value of the spectacular, and it's a subject that we're both very passionate about, and sort of new metrics of understanding texts.
Right, because they're a whole new audience now. Teen girls now get their own stuff.
Yeah.
And which we didn't get. So we had to read our grandmother's stuff, our mother's stuff, because there was no stuff.
Oh, we had Sweet Dreams.
Yeah. And did you?
For a very long time now, I've always felt that there was a gap in the market in romance for teen readers. There's no teen imprint anywhere.
But a Harlequin teen, but it's not...
It's not really romance.
No, though.
And it's very often love triangles. Mm. Where Sweet Dreams had a very strong romantic element, they actually didn't always end happily. The very first book, I think the guy dies.
Oh, oof.
The guy had, I think he had leukemia, and he dies at the end.
So it's tragedy.
But I'll tell you, it's one of my favourite books from that imprint. But it was just, like, very emotional. It was very centred on the female teen and their experiences in high school.
How close to current YA... Nothing.
I don't think it's close at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Because current YA...
angst.
Not just that. I find some of it... I mean, obviously it doesn't apply to everything because you have to look at each individual book. But as a general trend, I find there's something artificial about the way that they're written. It's like they're trying too hard. And I find that really frustrating because what I love about teen fiction is that it's very kind of... bare and emotional, and it really lays out all the kind of the personal conflicts that the narrator experiences.
Yeah.
And I find it really like a disservice to me as a reader if I'm reading first person, but I don't feel that anything would change if you turned it into third person, which I find a lot of teen/young adult tends to be for me. I'd be like...
So is that kind of like saying it's overwritten? There's too much...
know what it is actually. I don't know if it's because some popular books were written that that way, so now everyone's kind of writing the same way.
Some patterning.
But I just feel like first person should be very strong. The narrative should be very, very strong and very, very personal. And I don't find that in many of the teen romances or fiction that I read. Mind you, people still love it, so maybe I'm just old.
Or maybe there's just something about, to go back to your point about it being so linked to history, that we're in a different time span and we could be sweeter then. That maybe it was just sweeter and less...
Well, one thing I find very interesting about modern teen fiction is how the really successful ones have had a big element of spectacle. Thinking about things like Twilight and the Hunger Games here. And this kind of emphasis on on allegory rather than realism is so... I'm not quite sure what to make of this, but it's so... So
do you think
interesting.
That those are metaphors for sex?
Oh, I don't know about always. I think they can be.
I find that sometimes when you hear teen, I call them teen fiction, authors, they talk about the fact that, you know, you can't be too explicit. And I always think, you know, teens are obsessed with sex.
Yeah.
To write a teen novel where, you know, the guys aren't sort of obsessed with trying to get in the girls' pants and the girls aren't kind of really wondering what it's going to be like to lose their virginity... It kind of
placeful somehow.
It feels a little bit not quite true.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the value of some of the more spectacular texts and the dystopians, particularly, is they kind of have other things to be going on with.
Well, that's
like they have bigger problems.
It never stops us in romance fans, does it?
That's true. I'm thinking of the Veronica Roth's books that are coming out.
Oh, Divergent.
Divergent, which I thought was is a fabulous
yeah,
concept.
I really, really enjoyed Divergent.
Those kids have lots of things to worry about.
Yeah.
The romance is there, but it kind of has its place in the story against larger, broader agendas.
Yeah. I love those
and doesn't
books.
Suffer for it at all.
I really love those
They're great.
Books.
They're fabulous.
Oh, Triss is such a good heroine. Yep. Like, oh.
It was unsurprising to discover that that was kind of the next Hunger Games wave coming through. They're very clever.
That book,
oh,
right?
They're lovely. It's just, oh, they're it's great. Just such a clever concept.
It's
and it
dystopian.
Plays so well.
The heroine is just awesome.
Yeah,
she's just total hard ass.
Awesome.
But you know how sometimes when female characters or any of the male characters are really, really hard ass, you kind of can't relate to them?
Yeah.
You can always relate to Triss.
It'd be interesting to see if she does like it, though, because it's first person.
It is first person.
I don't mind. I actually am. I know there are many readers who won't read first person, so generally it is a genre thing, because if you want to write a romance and call it a romance, you're going to alienate many people if you don't write in third person. But as an individual reader, I don't consider that.
Is any of the current YA not in first person? I thought all this wave coming through was. I can't think of anything I've read that hasn't been first.
New adult, there's a lot of switching as well, kind of chapter
even the
about.
The lovely Cartier Malay is
from the hero's point of view.
Yeah. You know, that's another
thing.
Second
book deal.
That, well, actually, that's what she's going to do.
Tell the same story
in,
from any point of view. And whole
you sound
book.
So cynical.
In
sorry.
In the third...
Not be cynical about that.
Yeah. Well, in the third Divergent book, she's not just using Triss's viewpoint. She's using Fawr's as well. It's going to be alternating.
Yes, that opens it. We can't talk about this because she hasn't read them. It'll all be plot spoiled.
Because
in the third one, we get to see the much larger plot inside. The plot, the bigger plot, the bigger picture thing.
The bigger world.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited for the new one. I really love those books.
I was kind of annoyed because obviously the gap between the movie coming on, the third book should be well out by now, but they've held it back.
Yeah,
for the
it's
movie
October.
Release, so it's still coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of what I read for pleasure.
Yeah.
Because I don't write very much about young adult except Twilight, because I have a chapter on that.
Yeah.
And I really, really love dystopian young adult fiction. I love it.
Yeah. It's just my mum would enjoy that book.
Yeah.
Because it's not the current kind of it's not necessarily a young person's story. It's a gorgeously written, cleverly positioned story.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to have an age attached to it.
And the world in it is so rich.
Yeah.
And there's so many just memorable scenes.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to read this
book. It's good.
Yeah.
It's kind of challenging and it's very clever.
Yeah,
and the romance is important to it, but it's not above the bigger picture issues. So it's not crazy silly in that sense, whereas sometimes they are a bit kind of crazy silly.
I really like where Triss and Fawr are kind of really sensible about their relationship sometimes, and they both occasionally freak out, but a lot of the times they're like, nah, no drama, we've got to hold it down, we've got to hold it together,
so no
worry about this later. No love triangle.
No.
Oh,
no.
Okay, because I find the love triangle a bit problematic in my
no.
as well.
Really no love triangle.
No, love triangle. No, they've got to act like, you forget that they're 18-year-olds. The fact that it's a story about young people goes away very quickly.
Yeah, and they have to grow up so quickly. Yeah.
But I think the setting kind of justifies
helps. Yeah, it does. It helps.
So did Mills and Boons lose?
Yeah.
Did they lose the teen market when YA went and did its thing outside of category?
I don't know if Mills and Boon ever really had an explicit teen market. I don't know if teens were necessarily buying them. I think teens were certainly reading them.
Yeah, right.
But I don't think they were buying them.
And I think you always thought of them as your grandmother's Mills and Boon.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you did. Yeah. But that's what you snuck off the shelf. Though.
Yeah.
Or out of the garage or whatever they were kept.
Entry into adult romance.
Actually, my entry was Sydney Sheldon and whatever was on Mum's shelf that I could actually steal.
You're so funny. Mum's entry was her dad's Sydney Sheldon as well.
Was it? Yeah. It's like, I should never have been reading any of those things. My mother would be horrified.
Mine was
my mother would be horrified.
Mine was Clan of the Cave Bear. She has no one to blame but
herself. Oh, Jackie Collins, Sydney Sheldon. There's all those ones. You know, the torch under the bed, that sort of thing.
And if I can take this to a terribly academic place for a moment, and then I promise we can come out.
You're the only person here
who
can do that.
Pretend we can understand all the
terribly academic place. If you look at Foucauldian theory.
Oh, here she goes.
Yeah. Well, he talks about how typical sex history thinks that there was this period of repression between kind of the 19th century and the sexual revolution in the 60s. And he asks questions about whether or not there actually was repression, because he argues that because...
Is this how straight-laced Victorians?
Yeah. And he argues that because sex was so policed, there was necessarily more talk about it than ever, but it was just in different kind of discursive spaces.
Right.
And so I think if you think about the romance novel and the way people would sneak them off the shelves as this kind of discursive space for women in which sex could be discussed, that becomes really, really interesting. And the amount of, like, things I've read where people are like, my romance education came from the romance novels that I sneaked off the shelf. Mm. And then, you know, people talk to me about, you know, bad examples being said in romance novel, and I'm like, oh, they're not intended to be educational. And then you think about this, and you're like, oh, the way people are using these texts, you know, it fascinates me. It fascinates me.
Is that where the origin of this sense of people using them as instruction manuals actually comes from?
I don't know. Well, people have been worrying about what women have been reading forever. Like,
because they worry about what women do forever.
Like, there's this is wonderful... I say wonderful. It's actually really terrible, but fascinating letters to the editor in 1730 in this newspaper called The Universal Spectator in Britain, where this guy writes in about the romances of Eliza Haywood and Della Riviere Manley, and he says they ruin more virgins than brothels. Because there's this idea that...
They don't paper. Give them STD unless it's love.
But this idea that if women are even thinking about sex, then that kind of compromises
that's push
their
purity. The
and I think that's a lot of where the panic about romance comes from as well, because it is certainly from the 70s, it's a genre in which sex is very, very important and is considered in very different ways, which I think can be quite threatening for, you know, if you're coming at it from a hegemonic male perspective.
So in other words, like, your grandmother was being kind of subversive with her box of Mills and Boons.
Unless she was reading Betty Neal's.
Unless she was reading Betty Neal's, yes.
I think I don't want to make an argument that Mills and Boon are secretly subversive feminist texts, though I think they can be read that way. But I think a lot of them, a feminist reading can be sustained. And that's kind of what I'm more interested in, is what readers take out of the text rather than what might be actually... In them,
the text,
and there's this an
and
article.
I think if you look at individual books as well, and then compare them to the majority of the other books in the same imprint, so you'll get like a Kelly Hunter in a Harlequin Presents, where it's really very different, the dynamic. And then you go, well, look what she's done here with these. You know, it's still an alpha male. There's still sort of this conflict. There's a misunderstanding. Sometimes there might be, you know, a baby or something.
Yeah.
But it's a completely different story, and it's a completely different dynamic, and it's that you can really see that the heroine has her own power, her own agency, and that it's like a really adult relationship. There's no, you know, in some Mills and Boons, you feel like the heroine is still a child.
Absolutely,
and it's kind of, you know, the hero is a father figure who takes care of her.
Mm. But do you still get them? Are they like that? Not like that now, are they?
Well, actually, they're quite diverse. Some are. Actually don't know, because I don't read the ones that I know I won't like.
But there's this, a quote in 1986, Alison Light writes, "It's possible that reading Barbara Cartland could turn you into a feminist." And you look at Barbara Cartland novels with their quite insipid, passive virgin heroines, and then their kind of alpha-ish heroes, and kind of the fact that you can argue that a feminist reading can be sustained is quite interesting.
And I think you also have to think of the reader.
I think that's the most important
because
thing to
Because we always just assume that the reader is us, that every reader is reading it like us. But when you think about Mills and Boon, which is sold in, you know, so many countries, and in some of those countries, women have no power in society or very little power in even just their own household. So to read a text where the woman has sexual power over
or
the
any
man,
power.
She transforms
this man
her desire to be like
hers. You know, it's like a really empowering thing to be able to say to yourself, there's a way, there's a chance for me to kind of claim some type of agency, or even just to kind of get this message that there are other women out there who have agency, that maybe I can aspire to something more than what I have now.
Because I think one of the important factors in the happy ending is that he has to realise that he loves her, that she is this thing independent of him that he can't just kind of crush and remould in his own image. And it's very much in her world that they live happily ever after.
He tries to crush her.
Yeah.
And she, like, refuses
And
to
she's
be
just
crushed.
Like, nah, go away.
Yeah,
none
she
of
goes,
that.
Or she, like, gives him the big guilt trip, which I love. And she's like, you know, look what you're doing to me. This is not what I want to be. And then he has this big moral thing.
You have to have a catharsis.
Yeah. I love it. Those are the best Mills and Boons I have.
But in order for that to happen for you as a reader, the heroine has to start out in some lesser place. She can't start out in any ways equal to the hero. She has to start out somewhere lesser.
But I think Jennifer Kruse was the one who wrote like this argument where it's like that, and the real story in a romance is how you struggle to balance the power between the man and the woman.
But,
you know, have you looked at erotica at all?
I've looked a lot at Fifty Shades of Grey, but whether that counts as erotica is this whole other.
Well, to go back to your argument, it counts for readers.
Yeah.
It counts for a lot of readers.
Yeah, and people use that text in ways that are really not actually in the text, which it's fascinating, Fifty Shades of Grey. Yeah. I could talk about Fifty Shades of Grey for hours. But more broadly, I don't look a lot at erotica, no.
The reason I ask is because when I've read erotica in the past, I mean, I don't read it much now because I find it really disturbing, like emotionally disturbing, and it really affects me. Like sometimes I'll read one and I can't stop thinking about it for a week and I'm so like distressed over these poor characters.
You're not talking about Chrissy Neen's books, are you?
How did you know? But even, you know, some older erotic texts, there's a real kind of darkness in them.
Yeah.
And the stuff that you talked about, demisexuality, it's kind of in reverse, where there are many where they have the best sex with the worst people.
Mm.
And
have no emotional connection with them.
Yeah, and part of the appeal of erotica is that that's okay.
Yeah.
You can claim that sexual power and it doesn't have to mean anything. And you can take the enjoyment and then leave everything else behind.
This is one of the things I find really frustrating when people are talking about Fifty Shades of Grey and they're like, don't read that, that's rubbish. Go and read The Story of O. Go and read Desire.
I find that so horrific. Like, and how can you recommend that to someone who enjoyed Fifty Shades of Grey?
It's like, no, these texts are performing completely different work. And they're like, go and read Anais Nin. And I'm like, well, that's slightly better, but still not the same space.
I was actually thinking about her because when you read her stories, not only does she have very different settings, very different characters, they're really twisted and really surreal. And it's really about the woman kind of just goes out there and has sex and screw you, like, whatever. If you liked it, you liked it. If you didn't, you didn't. But I liked it and that was fine with me. What I find somewhat frustrating in erotic romance is I want that.
Yeah.
But I also want the happy ending at the end. Whereas I think erotic romance at the moment is really a romance and then we put lots of sex.
I was thinking about the arguments about whether Fifty Shades is romance and or whether it's porn, and that kind of led me to think about the differences between these two genres, and they're quite antithetical, which is why I find the claim that romance is porn for women very strange, because structurally they're very different. The romance is building to this single emotional climax, whereas porn is all about repetition and multiple climaxes. It's very, very cyclical. And Stephen Marcus, who writes a book about porn in the 60s, says that the ideal pornographic novel has only a like poor excuse for a beginning and it would ideally never end. And it just proceeds with, I think he calls it a minute algorithmical variation. And I was thinking about reading Fifty Shades of Grey and how, like, I remember when I read it the first time, I just started skipping over the sex scenes because they were all exactly the same.
Yeah, right.
And I'm like, well, this is performing this pornographic work, but then in porn, like, you don't really have emotions. It's what Marcus calls pornotopia, where everyone is always happy. No one really feels love or passion or jealousy or anger or anything strong emotion. It's just all about pleasure. And virgins in pornography, once they're deflowered, will sleep with anyone. They turn immediately into nymphomaniacs. I'm more familiar, I have to say, with 19th century pornography because I talk about this in a little bit in one of my setup chapters.
That's classier then.
Well, because I don't really work in visual media. I work in textual media and kind of pornography isn't written down so much in the 20th century because the film comes along and pornography isn't very good at language, so the film is kind of the perfect media
because
for
one
it.
Of the things that some people argue is that romance can never be porn because porn is all visual, which I don't actually agree with because I think porn can be in different media as well.
Well, I think the best, I mean, defining pornography has obviously been fraught for a long time, but I think the best way to define it is structural. Because I wish I could remember the name of this paper because I've been searching for it ever since, but I read this fantastic paper once that said the genre most similar to pornography is the musical because it consistently builds to these climaxes and it's usually got like a really just kind of poor excuse for a plot.
And you also have the repeating musical.
So you have the coda. Right? Yeah. And I wish I could find this
paper
again. I've
never seen another musical again.
When I see Les Mis next year,
the thing you take your grandmother to.
Porn and musicals.
So does that mean though, since you've read Fifty Shades probably several times,
if you took
the scenes out that you started skipping, took the sex scenes out, what happens to the story? Does it advance without them?
I think I pretty much concluded the work of the romance is done, basically, by the beginning of the second book. They break up at the end of the first book, and they get back together at the beginning of the second book, and there's really no doubt after that that, you know, things will come between them. There's kind of vague excuses, like they have lots of arguments, they're both very insecure, but, you know, they're both in it for the long haul. They're not breaking up unless one of them, like, dies or something.
Which is the threat factor.
And there is, a vague suspense plot, but it's not very good.
No.
And so, the allure then, I guess, is the sex scenes. And this is when I really, really started skipping them in the second and third ones. And there's not really much of a plot to hold them together by this point. So I think the first one is much more readable than the second two because the work of the romance is actually being performed largely in that first one. I'd say 90% of it is done.
So does it turn into porn once the romance is done?
Well,
structurally,
maybe Well, I think, I don't know if it's entirely porn, but it definitely moves more towards this pornographic cyclical structure.
Because another sort of differentiation that I've read, and this, I think it was May Lee, I don't know if you know her, she tweets, she said I think her theory was that it's in the language and the coding of the language that's used. In romance, there are certain, the language is code for certain things.
Yeah.
And in porn, it's a different code that they use. Mm. And in erotica, it's a different code. And if you look at the text that way, it's easy to, for her, it's easy to spot which is erotica, which is porn, and which is romance.
I did a close analysis of the virginity loss scene, and even looking at the language there, some of it is straight out of romance and some of it is straight out of porn.
Do you know that?
It's really, really interesting.
One of the things I find frustrating about e-published erotic romance is the language, is the gaze.
Yeah.
I find that a lot of the sex there feels like pornography because it feels like a male gaze. Yeah. So you'll get the threesome where she has sex with two guys at the same time.
Yeah.
I've read scenes where that's written very romantically, and I've read scenes where I've just been like, this is like not... Like, if I was a woman, I don't think I would find this very appealing.
Yeah.
And,
Which makes you do that. I can skip this bit.
Yeah.
Because it's not actually advancing anything.
No, I never skip the sex bits. Even the worst ones, I'm like fascinated by them. But I find it, again, I kind of feel slightly offended that it's encroaching, this male gaze is encroaching on my reading space that is really mostly feminine.
Yeah.
And I raised that because I'm not an academic, and that's about as deep as I can talk about this topic.
If you asked Elle James what she was writing, she would say romance, wouldn't she?
I don't know what she would say, but
I don't think people who love it think of it as romance. I don't think romance readers think of it as romance.
Well, I don't think I've ever found a romance reader who liked it, to tell the truth.
Really?
Well,
It depends on your definition of a romance reader, whether you've got a wide or narrow.
Yeah, this is true.
Definition.
But I also don't know whether they would consider it a romance. Because they also read outside of romance.
Yeah.
They don't have to just like romance.
Yeah. And I still haven't made up my mind whether I think it's romance pornography. I think it fuses these two generic frameworks in quite an interesting way. And it's interesting that at the same time you have Sylvia Day's trilogy, which gets, inverted commas, always talk about it as being a 50 Shades knockoff. And I think they were in fact published on the same day.
Yeah, I think she had worked on it in parallel, and it was just timing that...
They just kind of came out together.
Yeah.
Which is so, so interesting that these two books both became so popular at about the same time. And now everyone is really annoyed at Sylvia Day for artificially extending that trilogy into, what is it, 5 that she's going to do now?
Yeah, I think it's... quintet.
Because not a lot happened in the third book.
No.
It seemed to mark time.
Particularly considering the second one ended on such a strong note when Gideon kills that dude. And then the third one, you're like, oh, it's all going to get wrapped up. And then it was just, they had sex in a nightclub a lot. Like...
It was a curious thing, that third book.
Yeah, there was just... Because I'm trying to think of something that happened in it, and I can't think of an event
that's exactly happened. How I was thinking of it as well. It kind of marked time in an unoffensive way, but didn't take the story anywhere.
She explains herself in Facebook, though. She did it very graciously, I thought, because obviously people were kind of
pissed off.
And it was something... Because I haven't read the books. I think I've read the last one that came out.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you read it out of context of the first two, it's really hard to kind of get all the nuances. But she basically said one of the character's emotional journeys is done.
Yeah.
And we're switching to the other character who still has, I think, the heroine's journey was done.
Ava would be done,
And then now she has to switch to Gideon's journey, and he was not quite done. So until he catches up, she can't end it.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether that came out that way in the third book.
I really like Ava as a heroine, and I really hate Gideon, and I really want her to break up with him and date the rock star.
That's that ain't going
to
happen.
I know it's not going to happen. Yeah, he's such an asshole.
That's always a risk in love triangles, though, right? That people will invest their emotions on the wrong the person they don't end up with. Exactly. I mean, Charlene Harris was getting death threats because Sookie ended up with other
Sam.
Guy.
Yeah. Well, she ended up with Sam, and I love Sam. He's my favorite character.
Of course you would. Tiffany Rise. Although I don't think that she ended up with anyone.
Yeah, she does.
She ends up with. I mean, she did.
But she ends up with rings, which is the ultimate marriage symbol, even though there's no actual marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it ends with the three of them, right? Yeah. So it wasn't that she had to choose.
No, the interesting thing about the way that ended was that she didn't make any choice. And in actual fact, there's the journey is inside those relationships as opposed to moving or changing them.
What I also like, kind of more objectively, because emotionally I actually don't like it, but when I look at it, I think I kind of admire what she did, is that the two guys in that threesome have their own private relationship outside of Nora, which I thought was really amazing. Because normally in a threesome, in a romance, the woman is always at the center.
Yeah.
The guys can't have a secret affair behind her back. Like, that would be almost like cheating.
Yeah.
Mm.
Whereas she, in Tiffany Rice's novel, Nora accepts the fact that, you know, they also have their own relationships, and she has individual relationships with each of the two guys, and they also have a relationship as a threesome.
Yeah, all those characters have their own version of normal, which exists inside the.
All the other characters, though, in that last book, I'm like, who are all these people?
I only made it about halfway through the first one. I have to say, and then I think I went overseas and I forgot I was reading it, and then I tried to pick it up again, and it just didn't work. But I really found it quite hard to get into, and I'm not quite sure why that is. Because I can read anything, really. I will plow on through anything. And this
the interesting thing for me about those was you have a heroine who is has her happy ending, but it's defined in utterly different terms to the normal.
Absolutely.
Being the solid core marriage and the picket fence and the children.
Yeah.
Her, Nora, wants none of those things, and it's positioned as her happy ending and an alternative choice with kind of no judgment on that. And you don't get that anywhere else.
It's her happy ending rather than the happy ending. That's so interesting.
And I like that about those. Because it was all that happens inside the bubble of those three novels, and then the normal that applies to those characters and what it means as an alternative viewpoint, as opposed to trying to shoehorn it back into.
Yeah. So let me be happy the way I want to be happy rather than the way you think.
And don't make me have to have a traditional arrangement to find my happiness.
That's the first part of my conversation with Ainsley Payton and Jodie McAllister at the 2013 Romance Writers of Australia Conference. The audio for this podcast was produced by Rudy Bremer, and you can find the show notes at bookthingo.com.au/podcasts. Just click on episode number 4. In part 2, we talk about teen and new adult romance, including Twilight and its erotic descendants, and we spent some time talking about fan fiction and some of the trends and changes we're seeing in the genre. If you enjoy this podcast and don't want to miss the next episode, you can subscribe through your favourite podcast app or visit bookthingo.com.au, where we'll have a list of all the podcast episodes. Until then, happy reading!